Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The tide of national attention turned to Southwest Florida in late July when a 26-foot-long whale shark washed up on a Sanibel beach. It was later determined that red tide was to blame, and the animal's gigantic body was buried above the high tide line on the beach within a day of its washing up. But that whale shark was far from the only animal killed by red tide in recent weeks. A few hundred tons of dead marine life has been removed from just Sanibel, and this red tide has stretched more than 100 miles along the southwest coast of Florida. This includes many large fish like Goliath grouper, large marine mammals, animals like sea turtles, manatees, and dolphins, are countless smaller fish. And while reports are showing that fish kills are slowing down, we've begun to hear reports of things like maggots in the sand along the beaches. And that got us thinking about the broader impacts of so many dead animal carcasses, large and microscopic. So we've invited Dr. Heather Walsh Haney back on the show. She's coordinator for forensic studies, associate professor, and justice studies department chair here at FGCU, and she has a deep background in forensic anthropology. Heather, welcome back to the show. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Have you been to the beach lately? If so, have you seen any red tide-related impacts, like the reports of maggots that we've seen on social media? Or maybe you just have a question or comment. Either way, you can give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, in your studies of forensic anthropology, do you study the difference in decomposition on a sandy beach versus a wooded area or the like? Does it make a difference?
It does make a difference, actually. So to back up a little bit, my experience has been working with 11 medical examiner districts in Florida, so from the Keys all the way up to the Panhandle. And through those experiences, I, of course, have had and unfortunately have had buried body cases. So I have dealt with the exhumations and the identification of clandestine graves from victims that were buried in sand, that were buried in soils that have a little bit more clay in them, have been subaqueous or underwater, and also have been in forested areas. And absolutely, the substrate that the victim is buried in can speed up or slow down that process of decomposition. And the amount of vegetation, the numbers of scavengers that are there, all of those variables work on the decomposition process.
So where is decomposition fastest?
The fastest decomposition is going to be in a location like Fort Myers and Naples, and then right across the state from us, where we have high temperatures, high humidity, and where we have a lot of insect activity and access to scavengers. So what happens is the flies do not have the mouth parts to eat through our skin. So for them to oviposit, they're going to look for natural breaks in the skin, eyes, nose, mouth, ears, nether regions, and or injuries to the body. And then it's the fly activity where they're laying eggs and the eggs are pupating, then bring in vertebrate scavengers. In Florida, we have pig, possum, cat, our own dogs, you name it. Those animals are coming to all of the insects and the changes to our own bodies. So that high temperature, access to resources, and humidity. Because if the environment is too dry, an arid environment, what happens then is the skin turns to leather. You become a mummy and you're better preserved.
Well, there's nothing arid around here.
There is nothing arid around here, absolutely. So we've had – I've personally have cases where I've seen I've had nearly complete skeletonization in 5 days.
Wow, that's fast.
That is fast. And now this type of skeletonization is not typically what a lay person would think of, but it is the type of skeletonization where the pathologist or law enforcement, the standard tools that they would use for an ID are gone. And that's where they need someone with my expertise.
So what about sand and salt water, things that are on the beach? What kind of impact does that have?
Well, so in general, water is going to slow down the process.
Oh, I thought it was faster.
No.
Because the crime TV shows that I watched a long time ago with my mom said that.
Yes. No, actually, the water can slow that process of decomposition down. And if the water is cool, what happens is the fats in your body turn into a soapy material called adipocere. And then that can also work to help preserve your remains. So we ideally need not really very little water so that the decomposition process is allowed to go quickly.
And then sand versus soil?
Well, it really depends. If the soil has clay in it, that is going to slow down the process of decomposition. Sandy soils, in my experience, are pretty good at the process of decomposition. They don't seem to hinder the bacteria, our own gut bacteria, mm-hmm. from growing and proliferating. And indeed, the insects have access to the remains through the sandy soils.
So then you talked a little bit about gut bacteria. That makes me wonder, is there a difference in decomposition of people versus sea animals? Because like we're talking about the red tide and all the numerous fish and other marine life, would people decompose differently than them? I mean, obviously, we have different skin. We don't have scales.
Right. So I have worked with various agencies on unusual animal deaths, from sea turtles having been shot with spear guns to panthers having been shot. And from my own personal experience, the process of decomposition is the same. The speed of the decomposition has been roughly the same once they're out of the water. But then we're also dealing with biomass. How large is the animal? How large is the human? Because the larger we are, the longer the process of decomposition. And I have noticed that with animals that are in salty water is that the odor seems to be stronger, and folks seem to recognize the odor more quickly than animals that have died on the surface.
Yeah, it was pretty rank out there for a while.
Yeah.
And also it came it depended on how the water was – how the currents were going, how the wind was blowing, and you could just get hit right in the face. Were you out there during any of this?
I have been, yes. I have been out there just to – I'm working on the project, which is an underwater project, and so I've gone out there intermittently, and it has been awful.
Yeah. So what do you think about the burying of that many thousand-pound whale shark above the tide line out there on the beach? I mean, it was too big to move, but do you think that's going to be something that becomes evident down the road?
Well, one of the things we have to remember and take a step back is that animals are dying in those kinds of environments all the time without interaction with humans who think they're smelly and ugly. But I will tell you, if we make analogies to what the agriculture folks do when they have animals, birds, chickens, pigs, cows die in as a solo death or large numbers, typically what's going to happen there is that farmer is going to have a parcel of land that he's going to dedicate to the animal burials. And then they'll just go through that decomposition underground, which staves off the smell. Because this is a marine mammal from that water, from that location, burying it up on the up above the tide line, I don't think is a problem because, you know, that animal would naturally decompose while not on the shore for humans to see it, but in the water.
Yeah. Do you have any idea what kind of time we're looking at for a 26-foot-long whale shark? And I would imagine they probably have a decent amount of fat on them because they're...
Well, we're pretty hot right now. There's a decent amount of fat on him. I think it's going to be a lot slower than everybody hopes because of the fat. I don't know how far decomposed the animal was before it was buried.
It wasn't very. They think that it might have died fairly recently before it washed up. So it hadn't.
Okay.
I did read that in the paper.
So some of the things you can do when, for example, when I'm looking for clandestine graves is I look for changes in the soil. So what can happen is with the bacteria breakdown in your gut, you will animals and humans will have a stage called bloat, where your body, you know, fills up with those gases, and then that can cause the surface of the soil and sandy soils in particular to look like a mound. Then as the gases and the process of putrefaction, where you have fluids like cadaverine leaving your body, the soil will contract and you'll see cracks or fissures in the soil. Now, what can also happen is animals are going to visit that site because we have a lot of animals who feed on decomposing remains. And so the other thing we have to be aware of is, you know, how tolerant are we of allowing natural scavengers do the job that they need to do?
Yeah. So I'm wondering if the decomposition of something killed by a toxin is going to progress differently than maybe someone killed by illness or injury or old age.
So this is something I'm very interested in doing, and that is looking at some of the mammals that have washed up and estimating time since death and length of decomposition and how it compares to, you know, maybe putting some pigs that would have been butchered for grocery stores out on the surface and looking at a difference in the timeline there. Very interested in doing that.
But what, the comparison between toxins and other things?
And, yeah, just the comparison of the animals exposed to the toxins and the red algae to those that are just decomposing on the surface and seeing, first of all, if they progress properly. Because what should happen in the process of decomposition, whether underwater or on the surface, is you should have head down skeletonization. And I already mentioned to you how the flies oviposite at naturally occurring orifices. So by extension then, it makes sense that you'd have a skeletonized head, then shoulders, right, then torso. And it would be interesting to see if the algae bloom is affecting the normal progress of decomposition, because is it interrupting the other invertebrates, the insects that would naturally feast on decomposing remains?
It is interesting because I don't really think that I know what a toxin is actually doing. Is it beginning to necrotize tissue inside of the animal that's ingested it or breathed it in?
We don't know, and I hope that someone is doing necropsies on these animals to look at just that, to look at the different rate of decomposition from the inside and outside.
So we're hearing and seeing videos of people that are posting all over Facebook and stuff, all these maggots crawling out of the sand. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of these?
Not related to the red tide, but in the normal process of decomposition, there are maggots that leave the body. They migrate from the body, and that is a natural process in their growth cycle.
So maybe these are on the beach. So they've cleared away hundreds of tons. Mm-hmm. Not exaggerating, of dead sea life. Do you think these maggots that are still kind of hanging out in the sand, they may be left over from having been in those animals?
Yes. And depending upon what they may have buried before they, you know, started moving the sea life, the maggots will naturally, you know, migrate from dead remains, and they're looking for another food source and a safe place to grow and mature.
So could they be eating something that's underneath the sand that had maybe died naturally, like those little teeny coquina shells? You know, maybe those things have gotten some red tide and died. Or does the fly have to be able to get there to lay the ova?
And mind you, I'm not an entomologist.
I'm sorry. I'm totally kidding. This is where my brain goes.
But I am responsible for understanding the different types of fauna and plant life that affect the dead. But typically, it's been my experience that, you know, you want to have the source that attracts the adult flies so mm-hmm. that the adult flies lay eggs, and then there's pupation and the growing maggots into adult flies. So to me, they're looking for a large food source.
Yeah. So then I have another question about the fluids that are left over mm-hmm. During and after decomposition. You know, as we've all seen, there are tons and tons of fish that were just laying there and then they got scooped up and taken away. But what remains? Is there going to be fluid that is remaining behind after something has kind of partially decomposed in a given spot?
Well, if the soil had more of a clay in it or had a rich organic or humic layer to it, I would say yes. We would typically, in a forensic case, take a sample of that soil and look for the volatile fatty acids that would have leached from the body and then, you know, help to flesh out time since death or time since burial. But remember, we are on a beach where we have a tide cycle, and we're having not only, you know, water coming in with the tides, but we're also in rainy season. So I doubt that there are the fluids of decomposition still in that sandy soil.
Yeah, I wondered, because, I mean, it's sand. It doesn't really hold a whole lot.
It doesn't. And in the burials that I've had throughout Florida, we have not been very successful in when we take soil samples and sending them out for processing and really getting much out of sandy soil. So I'd be surprised if in this instance there was anything left over.
So the sand can kind of be cleaned, sort of. I mean, not, you know, Clorox cleaned, but...
Well, the water cycle is going to have a big effect on what remains in the sand.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Heather Walsh Haney. She's the Associate Professor and Justice Studies Department Chair here at FGCU, and she's also the Consulting Forensic Anthropologist for 8 Florida Medical Examiner Districts. And during her career, has helped locate and or identify human remains from Hurricanes Wilma and Katrina, and assisted in the recovery of human remains at the World Trade Center following the terrorist attacks of September 11th. 2001. But today, we're talking about non-human remains. We're asking about the thousands and thousands of pounds of dead marine life that washed up on area beaches in recent massive fish kills caused by red tide. If you'd like to ask her a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So we talked to someone from an organization that works with sea turtles before the show, and she said that they take dead turtle carcasses to a place that isn't available or accessible to the public because there are some people who want to get their hands on a turtle skull or shell, but that's illegal because they are a protected species. Is that something that you ever deal with in your world of forensics?
I have. I've been involved in law enforcement having interdiction of animals and human skeletons that come from other countries, and they try to bring them into the U.S. And then I've been called in to, you know, quickly, you know, evaluate whether the remains are human or not, and then try to come up with some ideas and estimates on where the animals may and humans may have come from. But there's a big trade in turtle skulls, turtle bones, and turtle shells. And I think it is only right that we make sure that the public cannot have access to those remains, because they would end up being sold and people would make a lot of money off of them probably.
What do they do with them?
Well,
like a collector or something?
They will collect the shell. The shell has its color from a keratin layer, almost like what our fingernail is, that lays over it. And the shell itself is bone, and that it comprises our spine and our rib cage and our own chest plate. The turtle shell is actually bone, and it is very beautiful. And some cultures really just value having access to turtle skulls and turtle shells. But there's also a trade for using them in art as well.
Is something like the impacts caused by red tide a possibility for opportunity for more research for forensic anthropologists, or does that really remain in the realm of marine biologists?
Well, what I love about anthropology is that and being a biological anthropologist is that I am holistic, in that I cannot work in a vacuum. I have to know the other experts and stakeholders that are involved in the various research topics that I'm working on. And nobody is an expert in everything. So I think it does really hold value that both marine sciences and, you know, a forensic anthropologist like myself that's uses knowledge, soil science, water science, as well as understanding the human condition and how we change, not only when we're alive, but through the death process. I think there is a lot to be learned. And then there's this whole idea of, you know, commensalism, how humans change the animals around us. And, you know, working with folks who do, zoology and other other lines of science like that. It would be very apropos for an anthropologist to work with them. And we do currently – we have some research going where we are looking at non-human pig carcasses and the process of decomposition on the surface and then in burials. And we're going to be doing some of that at the Buckingham facility. And so my hope is that, you know, through burials there, we'll be able to look at the changes at the shoreline with these different types of sea animals.
I think it would be really interesting to see the difference in how they progress. Like you said, if it goes from the skull down or not.
Absolutely. Just that small part of it could tell us so much.
About how red tide works on people.
Yes.
Well, not people, on things, on living things.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. Well, and I heard one of my colleagues the other day talk about a natural experiment. I mean, what's going on right now lends itself to these types of natural experiences if we're given the equipment and the time to get out there and collect those important data.
Mm-hmm. So we had you on the show last year because of a new body farm that the University of South Florida and Pasco County were starting. Do you know how things are going there?
I do. They have, I think, a couple dozen human remains donations in the ground and on the surface there. And that facility is a research facility. The other half of the quote-unquote farm, you notice I try not to use that term because it's just so gory. I like to say outdoor cantonment facility for research or something like that. But the other half of the facility, they really want to use for teaching. And they have actually reached out to me and some other colleagues of mine to help set up an opportunity for our students to learn out there. And then in the meantime, get our own at least non-human facility set up at Buckingham, hopefully to then in turn some humans at a later date. Because I don't know if you remember, but we have a pretty active human remains donation program at FGCU.
And I know you were telling me about that.
Yes. And it's right now, you know, everyone, our donees have chosen sometimes in living wills and sometimes through their families to donate their remains. And it is a long, laborious process to do the rendering, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. and to sometimes, if folks choose, to be able to put them at a facility where we can gain new knowledge in the process of decomposition, that would help us get through the loads of work we're doing.
Yeah. Are there any thoughts that you'd like to share with us? Any final thoughts?
Well, one of the things I'd like folks to realize is when we're dealing with dead animals, you know, we are dealing with their carcasses on a daily basis. And when we're trying to think about the ways in which we get rid of those carcasses, you know, you have burial, you perhaps have incineration by, you know, a licensed facility. Maybe you freeze them for a while and then load them up and get them to a facility for incineration. But there's not a lot of options out there. And wherever, especially when it's dealing with burial, the other thing we have to think about is the groundwater and that we are following the proper procedures to make sure that, you know, diseases, E. coli, fecal matter, not to mention trace metals, aren't coming into our groundwater. So
as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's about all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Heather Walsh Haney. She's Associate Professor in Justice Studies Department Chair. Heather, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your knowledge with us.
My pleasure.
It's always interesting.
Thank you.
When we return, starting next week, the Harry Chapin Food Bank of Southwest Florida is doing its part to help people being economically affected by the ripple effects of red tide by setting up its mobile food pantry. We're joined by its president and CEO to find out more. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.